Thank you. So first, thank you very much for the invitation to this conference. So I'm going to talk about gravitational waves in homogeneous universe. So actually, in this talk, I will cover two topics. And so one is the standard Silent method without redshift information. And second topic is about the effect of gravitational lensing on the distribution of binary black hole mergers. And these are the related papers. So if you get interested in these topics, please take a look at these papers. Okay, so as you know, the gravitational waves were observed for the first time in 2015. And this was a very big news, and people got very much excited about this discovery. And I myself also got very much excited and interested in this event. So I started to work on gravitational waves. But basically, gravitational waves we are observing is the mergers, the gravitational waves we are observing are from the mergers of compact binaries, such as the black hole and the neutron stars. And we can do the many different science using these mergers. But in this talk, I would like to convince you that these are very useful probe of cosmology and also astrophysics. So one very important application of these gravitational waves is the method, so-called the gravitational wave standard silence. And I will explain this in detail in the next slide, but by observing the gravitational waves, we can infer the mass of the inspiring compact binaries, and we can observe the amplitude of the gravitational waves, and by comparing the predicted amplitude and the observed amplitude, we can directly measure the luminosity distance to the merger event. And this is actually very unusual in astronomy. So in astronomy, we can always measure the redshift, but measuring distance is very difficult. That's why, you know, measuring the Hubble constant is also very difficult. But in this gravitational waves, we can directly measure the luminosity distance, including the H node. So we can use this to directly constrain the Hubble constant. And this method was proposed back in 1986. And so this is a little bit more explanation about the standard Silent method. So what we observe is something like this. So we have a binary, compact binary, and this binary emit gravitational waves and lose energy so that their orbit becomes smaller and smaller, and at some point they merge and emit gravitational waves. So during this phase, they keep emitting the gravitational waves, and this is merger, and this is ring down phase. And in this region, this waveform can be computed sort of analytically by using the post-Newtonian method. And in this region, we have to use the numerical relativity. And but anyway, so important point is that in this phase, in the lowest order approximation, we can compute the change of the time dependence of the frequency, something like this. So this depends on both the frequency and also the chirp mass. So by observing this in spiral phase, we can constrain the chirp mass. And of course, this chirp mass determines the amplitude of these gravitational waves. But when these gravitational waves propagate this amplitude is decay by a factor of 1 over distance. This is luminosity distance. So from this frequency change, we can get information on this Chapman's and which predict the amplitude of this gravitational waves. And by observing this, we can directly constrain this luminosity distance. But from this observation, we can know the luminosity distance. But in order to constrain the H naught or some other cosmological parameters, we have to know the redshift of that event, which we cannot usually get from the gravitational wave observation. So we have to rely on other observations to get redshift information. And so we usually need a detection of electromagnetic counterpart, like a short gamma ray burst or the kilonova to measure redshift, or we need to detect the host galaxy of this gravitational wave event to get redshift. And this is very challenging because the localization accuracy of the gravitational waves is very poor. So currently, it's something like 10 over 100 square degree. And in the future, we can improve this down to like 1 square degree, but still it's too large to securely identify host galaxy. And so this standard silent, as you know, this standard silent method was applied to the real data, to this event, neutron star, neutron star merger event, GW170817. And for this event, people successfully detected the electromagnetic counterpart including the gamma ray and also the optical and radio. And they also securely identified the host galaxy of this event, from which they get the redshift of this event. And by combining this redshift information with the luminosity distance measurement from gravitational waves, they somehow constrain the Hubble constant like this. So this constraint is not very weak, not very tight, but this is from just one event. So in the future, if we observe many more neutron star, neutron star merger event, we can improve constraint on the Hubble constant. Yeah, but it's not very straightforward because there are many challenges to apply this standard silent method to real observation. So for example, the optical electromagnetic counterpart is a kilonova, but this kilonova is very faint. And if we go to the, for example, the 400 megaparsec, which is a kind of a typical neutron star merger discovered by the design sensitivity advanced LIGO. This magnitude of kilonova is something like 24th magnitude. And if you are familiar with astronomical observations, finding this 24th magnitude transient is very challenging. So this is very challenging. And of course, if we detect a short gamma ray burst, then we can identify the host galaxy and the electromagnetic counterpart more easily. But we can observe this short gamma ray burst only when the event is highly on axis, which is kind of rare. And these are for the neutron star merger. But currently we are mainly observing this black hole merger event. And people are of course trying to find some electromagnetic counterpart for this black hole merger event. But so far it's not successful. So that means that this electromagnetic counterpart from this black hole merger is either very faint or there is no counterpart. So So that means it's kind of a very hopeless to identify redshift of this black hole merger event. So, so one question I want to address in this talk is that is there any way to do this standard silent cosmology without redshift information? And actually there is one way, which is this cross correlation approach. And this idea is very simple. Suppose we have many observations of gravitational wave sources, and then these gravitational wave sources should follow the large scale structure of the universe, because this gravitational wave, black hole merger event comes from galaxy, and the galaxy follows the large scale structure. So these gravitational wave sources should follow the large scale structure. That means that it should correlate with the other tracers of large scale structures like galaxies. So if we take the cross correlation between the gravitational wave sources and galaxies, we should be able to detect that cross correlation. But for this gravitational wave sources, we only know the luminosity distance. And suppose we use galaxies with known redshift, then by cross correlating these two populations, we can statistically constrain the luminosity redshift distance relation. And so this idea, if you work on the weak ranging cosmology, for example, this idea should be very similar. Should be very familiar, because we are using this clustering redshift technique to calibrate the source redshift distribution of source galaxies for cosmic share analysis. So our idea is very similar to this clustering redshift, but we can use this idea to also do this standard silent analysis. And in this analysis, we don't have to do any follow-up observation of gravitational wave sources. So I will explain this idea more explicitly. So we have a spatial distribution of gravitational wave sources and a spatial distribution of galaxies. And we take these two populations. And for these galaxies, we know the redshift. And we can convert this to distance. But for these gravitational waves, we can directly measure the distance. So assuming some cosmological parameters, we can convert this redshift to distance. But if these two distances are different, then these galaxies and these sources are not physically correlate with each other, so that spatial correlation should be very weak. So in this case, cross correlation signal should be very small, like this. But if their distance are very similar, then we should be able to observe the very strong cross correlation signal. But again, if these galaxies are located, for example, the farther distance from these gravitational wave sources, then again, the spatial clustering should be very weak, so that we should observe this kind of a weak cross correlation signal. But so this is very simple, but one caveat is that we also have to take account of this gravitational lensing effect, because this gravitational lensing also affect the distance estimate of the gravitational wave sources, like this. So by the gravitational lensing, this distance source may be amplified or de-amplified due to the structure along the line of sight. And we usually write this magnification by this factor mu. So So this is the magnification factor. If this mu is larger than unity, then the source is magnified compared with the homogeneous and isotropic universe. And this mu is smaller than one, then that means the source is demagnified. And in the weak ranging limit, this mu is related to this kappa. This is this is called a convergence, which is basically the integrated surface mass density along the line of sight. But anyway, what we observe is this, rather than this one. That means that this observed distance is also affected by gravitational lensing. And so this is kind of a problematic because this lensing can also produce apparent clustering, because this lensing effect is also related to large scale structure of the universe, so that it also have a spatial pattern on the sky. So without lensing, this distribution should be, if you take the constant constant distance, this distribution should be very isotropic. But if you take account of the gravitational lensing effect, in some direction, we have over-density, and in some direction, we have under-density, so that this constant distance should be modulated like this. And this also induce the additional clustering pattern on the sky. But anyway, so this is some calculation of the cross correlation signals, including this weak ranging effect. So we can write down the cross correlation like this, and this is the physical correlation that I mentioned earlier, and this is the clustering, apparent clustering due to the weak ranging. So this shows the cross correlation signals as a function of the galaxy redshift, where I fix the gravitational wave sources at this redshift between 0.9 and 1.1, and move the move the redshift of spectroscopic galaxies, and we observe a clustering signal like this. So suppose we consider the cross correlation between the gravitational wave sources and the foreground galaxies. We still see some strong clustering signal because lensing affects the distance to these gravitational wave sources, and lensing comes from all the matter fluctuation along the line of sight. So that means the matter distribution at this galaxy redshift affects the distance to this gravitational wave. So this produces the apparent clustering. And as I said, if the location of these gravitational wave sources and the galaxies are same, then we can observe the very strong clustering signal. And if this is a background, then this clustering is weak. And so basically, this is the basic picture. But in order to compute this, we have to convert this redshift to distance. So if you assume the long cosmological parameter, then this whole curve moves or back or forth. So by monitoring this, we can actually constrain the Hubble constant and other cosmological parameters.
So Masamune, so from your expression, it looks like you're making the Limber approximation. Is that right?
Sorry.
So from your expression, it looks like you're making the Limber approximation.
Yes, yes.
So have you checked the validity of this approximation for the regions that you're interested in?
Yeah, actually, I haven't checked the validity, but so it should affect the accuracy of this calculation. But the purpose of this paper is to just present this idea. So I just assume the Limber approximation and computed this.
Right. Yeah, but the sign even of the correlation can be wrong under Limberger compared to the actual, you know, the actual sign for correlations at different redshifts.
Yeah. The problem, I guess, if the redshift overlap is a small, then you can get very wrong results from.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, that's right. So it also depends on the size of this slice, for example.
Right.
So if we add up a very thin slice, then it should be more significant. Yeah, but well, anyway, so this is the basic idea. And so this is a very simple Fisher matrix calculation on how well we can constrain the cosmological parameters from this approach. So as a specific example, I assume the gravitational waves from the third generation experiment, because for this technique to work, we need a very kind of a large number of binary black hole mergers. So it's not very easy to apply this method to the current observation, but this should be, we can apply this method to the future observation, where we can find many black hole merger events. But anyway, so I assume this, and also spectroscopic galaxies from Euclid, and I can get this kind of constraint. And one important note is that this L max is the maximum a multiple I can use for this analysis, and it is related to the positional accuracy of the gravitational wave observation. So even if we cannot locate the host galaxies, it's still very important to have a good localization accuracy, because this accuracy on the cosmological parameter depends on this L max. And of course, if we go to the smaller scale, this L to 300 corresponds to the smaller, using the information down to smaller scale. And we can improve this constraint on cosmological parameter by using the smaller scale clustering information. So still the localization accuracy is very important, but basically it looks like this method works, and the tight constraint on Hubble constant, and also by going to higher redshift, we can also constraint on the other parameters like dark energy.
Sorry, what galaxies are they from Euclid?
Yeah, Euclid, yeah. This is SPECG galaxies from Euclid.
This morning, are you assuming a different galaxy bias in every direction? Marginalizing or
pressure
dilution of the bias?
Yeah, I think in this analysis, I assume the simple bias model, like a constant bias plus some linear term that depends on the redshift and marginalize over those parameters. So I have, if I remember correctly, I have two parameters, like a constant bias and also the redshift dependent term.
Do you have any thoughts on the accuracy of assuming that?
Yeah, accuracy depends on what I assume for that part. So if I assume a completely independent bias for different redshift beam, then it should degrade the accuracy. But it's something we have to also check.
So I guess the other question is, do you use the autocorrelation of galaxies as well? Because I mean, that would constrain the bias.
I think I also included autocorrelation in the analysis. Yeah, but I have to double check because I wrote this paper a few years ago. So. but I think I included, yes.
Is LMAX? Is value of LMAX are you using sort of corresponds to like degree scales, I guess?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So this is a little
10 degrees or something, or 100 degrees, like you were saying before. Then how much does it degrade?
Yeah, it should degrade.
Yeah, like, do you know like roughly the scaling?
Scaling, I haven't checked, but. Yeah, but it should be sensitive to L max because the number of modes we can use is a very steep function of this L max. So. But anyway, so this is the summary of the first part of my talk. So I proposed this cross correlation technique, and it seems it works. But of course, this is just one application of the cross correlation analysis, and there should be more applications of cross correlation between the gravitational wave sources and the galaxies or whatever, large scale structure tracer. For example, there are some other papers like we can infer the progenitor of the black hole, binary black holes, by measuring the bias from clustering, for example. Or in my analysis, I considered the angular clustering, but of course we can also extend this to the 3D clustering, which looks very interesting.
You have a hockey stick.
Now it works. So there is a lot of room to explore for this cross correlation analysis. So this is the first part, and so if you have any questions, so if not, so let me move on to the second part of my talk. So of course, from this LIGO-Berg observations, people discovered many binary black holes, and in particular, people discovered many binary black holes with mass from 10 to 30 solar mass, which is not totally expected before the gravitational wave observations. So people are wondering what's the origin of these binary black holes. And so there are many different scenarios for this formation of binary black holes, including the population 1-2 stars, or the population 3 stars, or the more, interesting for theorists, maybe a primordial black hole, which is formed during the, for example, the inflation. And for these different scenarios, the main difference comes from the different formation time. So this is just a very schematic picture showing the difference of the formation redshift. For this population 1-2 stars and the black hole formation, black holes are formed in nearby universe. But for this population 3 stars scenarios, so this population 3 stars means first generation stars that form when gas contains no metal. So this is a first generation star. That means that this should be formed very early, like redshift from 10 to 30. And of course, for this primordial black hole scenario, this black hole should be formed very early, like redshift beyond 1,000. So these scenarios predict a different formation redshift, but all these scenarios predict some black hole merger event at redshift zero. And so this is because there is a delay time between the formation of the binary and the merger, because it takes some time for this binary to in spiral and merge. And it can be a hub time, so that even for this primordial black hole scenario, we have a significant number of merger events at redshift zero. So by observing a gravitational wave event at redshift zero, we can still get some information. But some people argue that in order to distinguish these different scenarios, it's very important to go a very high redshift, because if you go a very high redshift, you can easily see the huge difference between these different scenarios. And for example, this is a paper by Nakamura et al., which studied the redshift distribution of event for three different scenarios, like a POP1 and POP2 scenario, this blue line, and this POP3 scenario by this red line, and this PBH, primordial black hole scenario by this dashed line. And you can see a huge difference at high redshift. So they argue that we have to go to a very high redshift in order to really distinguish these different scenarios. And this looks a very high redshift, but if these third generation experiments, like Cosmic Explorer or the Einstein telescope comes online, then we can actually easily observe merger event at these redshifts. So this should not be a very distant future. And this is also another paper by these people. They also check the maximum possible redshift for astrophysical scenarios like a POP1, POP2, or POP3 scenario. And they argue that maximum redshift from the astrophysical origin should be around redshift 40. So that means that if we observe any event beyond redshift 40, that means that it supports the primordial black hole scenario. So high redshift event is very important, but one important thing is that...
How do we measure redshift?
Yeah, so that's the point of this talk. So high redshift event is very important, but as I said, you know, we cannot directly measure the redshift from the gravitational wave observations. So what we measure is luminosity distance. And in order to compare that observation with this kind of prediction, we have to convert the luminosity distance to the redshift. But as I said, this luminosity distance measurement is affected by gravitational lensing. So that means that this lensing magnification or demagnification can bias the redshift inferred from the luminosity distance. So this lensing magnification can potentially be very important to interpret this high redshift event. So I just show you some equations. And so as I said, the redshift is not direct observable, so that we have to infer the redshift from distance measurement. So we can define the observed redshift like this. And so this is the distance we measure from the gravitational wave observations. And we don't know what's the magnification factor for each gravitational wave event. So we usually just assume the standard homogeneous and isotropic universe distance to convert observed distance to redshift. So this is the observed redshift, which is affected by gravitational lensing. And actually for this chirp mass observations is also affected by redshift. So we have to correct for the redshift in order to get the, you know, intrinsic chirp mass. And but this is also affected by lensing like this, because this observed redshift can be different from the true redshift. So this observed chirp mass can also be different from the true chirp mass. So in this paper, I explored the distributions of binary black hole mergers, taking full account of the gravitational lensing effect, both strong and weak lensing. And I consider the different scenarios, like I said, these three different scenarios, and I also consider the different experiment, including the current advanced LIGO and the future experiments.
So, question. So I guess you have to make some model for nonlinear structure formation.
Or? Yes, so I will explain that later. Yeah. So one important note is that sometimes, you know, lensing effect is very strong. We observe the multiple image of the single source. So this is the multiple image. And like I said, the localization accuracy of the gravitational wave observation is very poor. So it's not very straightforward to see which events are actually multiple images of the same source. So in this analysis, I just assume the treat the multiple images as a distinct event and treat separately. And in this case, you know, when we have multiple images of a strong lensing event, of course, many multiple images are magnified, but some images can be demagnified. That means its brightness can be fainter than the original brightness. So this shows the example from the well-known quasar strong lensing system. And so these are the magnification predicted by mass model. And for these three images, mu is larger than unity. That means these images are magnified. But for this fourth image, this magnification is like a 0.3. That means this is 0.3 times fainter than the original quasar image. So I compute the magnification PDF by taking account of both the strong and weak lensing.
So can I ask a question? So, I mean, you can in principle, and because you see the entire waveform for these mirrors, you could identify if there are two images kind of match each other because they have exact same waveform up to some amplitude
difference. Yeah, that's right. With some time difference.
With some time difference, right? So in principle, if you see two events which are high enough signal to know, you say, okay, they have exactly the same, up to some risk, they have exact same structure, and identify them. Could you use that to break the degeneracy, basically, or?
So that's something we have to check. I mean, it is also possible that we have two distinct different events that have a kind of a similar waveform.
So false positive, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
False
so,
positive.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Maybe that's too big of a problem.
I think the rate for that is very large. For the two matching, well, I guess it depends on signal to noise, but
yeah.
For the two things to match exactly.
There have been claims actually for this.
Right, but apart from claims, I just given the statistical significance we expect, you could see to exact two waveforms that are the same up to the noise. We are cross-correlating two different waveforms.
Yeah, so I think it's very important to check how many false positives we have from I don't think there is any work that addresses that kind of question.
Mm. Well, besides the claims in the literature for having seen matches.
No, but they haven't actually matched the waveforms. They matched them in
the claims of the waveforms were consistent within the noise.
I thought they
just matched the parameters, not the waveforms.
Right, parameters don't match unless, like, you know, the waveforms, you know, match within the noise.
We discussed this once before. I don't think the two are exactly the same.
Well, their paper, you know, they have lots of waveforms.
Yeah. I suggest that we allow the story.
Yeah, okay, so I just developed a hybrid model. So weak lensing comes from the power spectrum, and for strong lensing, I just do the Monte Carlo calculation, assuming the normal galaxies as a lens object, and combine those calculations to get this PDF. And one important point is that Of course, we have a long tail toward high magnification, but we also have a tail at very low magnification that corresponds to the demagnified image. So actually, this ranging effect is very important in some parameter space. And so this is the example for the advanced LIGO. And this redshift distribution for this thick solid line corresponds to distribution with ranging, and this thin solid line corresponds to distribution without ranging. So for this case, there is no difference between thick and thin line. That means you cannot see any ranging effect, but in this high Chapman's tail, you can see a significant tail produced by ranging. So this is the excess due to the highly magnified event. But for our next generation observation, like a cosmic explorer, situation is more interesting because you can also see this very significant tail also for this redshift distribution, like this. And so this shows the average magnification. And you can see that the magnification is significantly lower than the unity. That means this tail is produced by a highly demagnified event. So as I said, the observation of high redshift event is very important to distinguish different scenarios. But if you once you take account of the ranging effect, ranging produces an apparent tail that is caused by a demagnified event. So you have to really take account of this ranging effect in order to, you know, properly interpret the observed distribution of gravitational wave events. So finally, I also comment on the multiple image pairs. So as I said, I use the Monte Carlo calculations for this strong ranging part. So I can also predict the expected distribution of multiple image pairs taking account of the section effect. And actually, this is very interesting because for advanced LIGO, because of the selection function, the distribution is very different from what we usually know for the quasar ranges. So this shows the distribution of time delay versus the magnification. And these are the typical events we expect for the multiple image pairs. And as you can see, the time delay is very short. Like this is 1 day. So most of the events have the time delay between less than 1 day. And their magnification is also very similar. So what we expect is something like this. So very similar event separated by less than 1 day. But the expected rate is also very low. And so maybe I'm not sure if you know this event, but actually last week, so there was some discovery of two events that are separated by only 21 minutes. So some people got excited about this, saying that this may be a strongly lensed pair of the same event. And this localization map also looks kind of similar. So, but if you carefully compare this and this, actually this is significantly different. So actually they are coming from the different part of the sky. That means this is most likely this is not strong ranging. But one question is whether this 21 minutes difference is reasonable or not. And based on my calculation, the answer is actually yes. So 21 minutes correspond to this. And so this is the typical event we expect. So actually this very short time delay of 21 minutes is actually expected for this strong ranging of advanced LIGO. But if you go to the next generation experiment, situation is completely different because we can easily observe the high redshift event even without ranging. So we expect a time delay of like a 10 or 100 days. This is the normal time delay for galaxy scale lensing, and the magnification is also very different. But we can observe the very huge number of strong lensing events like this.
Sorry, what was the rate in the previous case?
Previous case?
1 per year, less than 1 year.
Okay.
We're going down.
Okay. Yeah, less than one. So but it depends on the model. So different model predicts quite a different value. Okay, so this is the summary of the second part. And lensing is very important. And I also made some predictions on the multiple images. And so this is the conclusion. So because I don't have time, so basically the main message is that synergy between gravitational waves and large scale structure or gravitational lensing is very interesting. And I just show some examples here, but I think there are many more studies we can do with these synergies. So I stop here. Thank you.
Are there further questions?
So I guess I missed it in one of your thoughts, but if these events were coming from much farther away, does that mean the timing would be very different in these lensing events? It's maybe some one of your thoughts.
Which one?
Suppose there were primordial coming from very large Z, then what would the timing of the, what kind of timing would you expect in the lensing? Multiple images.
Time delay, you mean time delay should be much longer?
Much longer, no?
Actually, not really, because time delay mainly depends on the redshift of the foreground lensing galaxy rather than the background source.
It's coming through much more to get to us. No?
Yeah, it increases time delay a little bit, but not huge. Number.
Have you studied that?
Yeah.
Do that, or I missed it?
Actually, in this paper, I present predictions for all the different models, like a POP1, POP2, and POP3, and PBH.
So you're saying this would not be a good diagnostic?
Right, that's right.
Since there are no more questions, I suggest that we thank Professor Funa again.